FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Financial Survival Network is brought to you today by Orin Resources, a junior exploration company with the appetite of a major. It's hot on the trail of the next globally significant discovery, creating enormous potential upside for you, the shareholder. Orin is one of the most aggressive exploration companies pursuing high-grade, scalable gold and copper deposits and has a premier seven-project portfolio, including its two flagships, Committee Bay in the Arctic and Sombrero in Peru. Orin's unparalleled technical team and highly experienced management has a history of success in advancing and monetizing exploration assets. No wonder Orin's been called one of the best in the junior exploration sector. Orin trades on the TSX and the NYSE under AUG. To learn more, go to orinresources.com. That's AURYNResources.com.
The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz. It's April 3rd, 2019. Well, things are slowing down. At least they certainly appear to be in the United States. That is, elsewhere, they've already been slowing down. IMF report 70% of the world's economies are in slowdown mode. Well, what's going to happen next? Where do you need to be invested or uninvested from? That's really the question. And we're very fortunate to have with us the extremely bright and talented Danielle Park, jugglingdynamite.com. Happy Wednesday, Danielle.
Oh, thank you for that nice introduction. You're perking me up today, Kerry.
I'm trying. I know it's not easy. This is like a doldrum period. It's like spring is officially here, but it hasn't officially sprung. Certainly not in your neck of the woods, to our neighbor to the north, where you're having a nice little blizzard. And, here you thought you were going to put away your overcoat and bring out the spring clothes. And instead you had to go reclaim the galoshes. And I don't know how you guys do it. I used to, right?
Yeah, you get used to it. And also, the rest of the world has its own particular brand of weather complexity and threat at all times. So, It's a small thing in the big picture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. The weather, just like economics and cycles, comes and goes. And, just like the waves at the beach,
Yeah, and I'm more concerned, frankly, about the winter of our economic picture up here than the winter of our season, as we look at all the things that were driving the Canadian economy over the last decade in particular, mostly housing related, construction related, heavy job creation in that sector. Of course, the most levered sector that there is, the most widely owned asset, the most heavily lended against by the Canadian banking system.
Right.
And we've got it really in full-on deflation mode now, certainly led by the hot sectors that led the upcycle, which were the Vancouver and Toronto areas. But but it infected most of Canada in many different areas, this whole boom in our housing sector. And so now, people are holding a lot of expensive real estate. And of course, the markets that are deflating the most are also the most indebted, right? They're the ones that had the highest mortgage balances. And so the cash crunch is well and truly on. They were also the areas that drive the bulk of the consumption spending in our country, of course, where the higher income people are concentrated. And that's why they can borrow those big mortgages, because they have the income. But even, that, if you look at the median household income in Vancouver is $80,000 a year, which is, high relative to many parts of the country. But if you look at the relative price of the average price of a home there is still $1 million. So you're still, even though it's come down considerably in the last couple of years, it is still 12 and a half times the median household income, which makes it still in the full on completely unaffordable category for most people. And people think that doesn't matter. Some people think, well, it doesn't matter because there's foreign investment and there's, you know, there's people that have cash buyers. Let me tell you something. Cash buyers are a tiny fraction, a tiny percentage of the owners. And second of all, even the ones who have bought cash and don't have a mortgage on these properties, don't like to see their balance sheet go south when the values begin to decline. And now you've got this perfect correlation in Canada because our economy was so driven by this sector. As the prices fall there, the economy weakens further. The profit profit scenario comes under compression in most sectors are affected by this, whether it's from finance to services to, you know, construction, transportation, materials, every part of it is impacted. Lumber brokers, I know, are having a hell of a time. So it's everything all together, and then also the job market, right? So you start to see negative impact and collateral damage across all that, and our stock market is vulnerable, of course, in that mix as well. And so now you've got a full on storm hitting Canadians.
Yeah, certainly do. And you know, it's amazing because during the U.S.'s financial collapse, Canada was sitting pretty. You know, the resource sector was still doing pretty well. Gold prices up, oil prices were skyrocketing. Everything was looking good for Canada, and everybody felt optimistic and borrowed to the hilts. And now we've lost the greater fool in the Canadian real estate market, right? The Chinese, that was every bubble depends upon a greater fool, right? Because without a greater fool, you can't have a bubble. And that greater fool is somebody who thinks what you're selling is worth more or will be worth more shortly than what you're selling it for. And, you know, that's the problem is.
Well, the other impetus there also was for money leaving other countries,
like
looking for land banks. So looking for currency diversification, looking for asset diversification, looking for government diversification, quite honestly, looking to escape the potential for clawbacks in their home country. And that's been relatively successful for them. So those are the reasons why some of those inflows were price indiscriminate, right? They were not looking at it based on a rational multiple times their income. They were looking at it for alternative reasons. And of course, now you see with the cash crunch building at home, with the construction sector in decline, even in China, and with a lot of vacant properties there as well, Australia as well. You know, this theme is really linking us with Australia, who has more household debt to income than we even do, but we're the top two worst in the world. Kind of a dubious distinction. And I think it's very similar to what happened in the 80s with the Japanese bubble at home. You know, they had a huge manufacturing run, everyone was talking about them becoming the biggest economy in the 80s. And then, huge speculation, big debt bomb in their property market, money flowing to other places, buying up parts of the rest of the world. And then all of a sudden it bursts at home. And they start putting capital restrictions on, and all of a sudden money flows out like the tide leaving the foreign markets. And that's really what we're seeing right now with the Chinese money receding.
Yeah, interesting. And nobody ever thought it was going to happen because they were so much smarter and brighter than everyone else. And yet it looks like they fell into the same trap as the Japanese, as the Europeans before them. The greater fool has seen his income and lifestyle diminish. So there's not the need to smuggle the money out of China like there was. You know, it's amazing, Danielle. I was in Las Vegas, and I just view Las Vegas much like Vancouver and Toronto as sites of Chinese colonization, you know, where they've really just taken cities over. And not through any overt practice of, let's just take over these cities. You know, they hold certain attractions to the Asian market, and the illusion,
gambling,
gambling, which is, but gambling with the illusion of privacy, that somehow the Chinese government won't find out that they're blowing millions of dollars at the table that they're not even supposed to have. But the reality is the three out of the four major gaming companies in the U.S. earn most of their profits in Macau. I'm talking about Wynn Resorts, Sands Resorts, the Venetian, and MGM. A large chunk of their profits come from there. So to think that they won't be sharing data is kind of absurd, but that's just an aside. It's just interesting that Vegas is now booming. There's a Chinese casino being built at the same time that it was declining really up until 2 years ago. Same time, we have Vancouver and Toronto, maybe New York City and maybe LA taking hits from a withdrawal of Chinese investment.
Yeah. And, you know, I think the Caterpillar earnings coming out this month, you've got a bunch of warnings about their downturn in sales. And there was a Deutsche Bank report out this morning that summarized it really well. Mm-hmm. They said, you know, that synchronized global growth that everyone was talking about for all the same reasons in the past decade. Well, that synchronized global growth has collapsed together. A synchronized global growth collapse is how they worded it. And if you look at it, it makes perfect sense, because we had a decade long of super national monetary policy. So driven way beyond any kind of boundary, geographical boundary. This is top down from central banks around the world, driving cheap money backed by government into financial intermediaries. And then you have, at the same time, you know, falling taxation rates for the corporate side, consolidations and mergers gone crazy, which takes out competition, puts pressure on wages to the downside. At the same time, you have globalization that allows cheap labor overseas to be utilized. And you had the regulatory decision, which was basically worldwide, to let companies buy back shares. Mm-hmm. So those five factors were international.
Yeah, which is complete
madness. And so they drove similar trends all over the world. And now those five trends, all but QE, which is still working at a lower, like it's still, there's still QE going on in the world. But the other four factors are all in a sort of wobble and reverse, at risk of going the other way for a while.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, you watch this stuff unwind, and this is what we've been talking about, what was going to happen. The fact that they allow these companies to buy back their shares, you know, I'm all for laissez-faire and all that. But, you know, it really is part of a fraud, because why do companies buy back their shares, Danielle? There are some legitimate. Yeah, right. There are some legitimate reasons to buy back your shares when you have an unbalanced capital structure and, you know, you want to realign it. But all these guys were doing was, hey, if we have less shares and we can keep the earnings the same, even because our top line growth is not happening, witness like IBM and many other companies, we just keep buying back the shares. It'll look like, in the world, the distorted world of securities analysts, that we're becoming more profitable, which we are per share, but we've got all this debt that we've taken on, or we blew all this cash that we had in the treasury that we could have invested for higher returns.
Rainy day fund, Carrie, putting it aside for a rainy day. So you can make strategic acquisitions at the bottom with cash, rather than, you know, destructive acquisitions at the top with overvalued shares and debt, which is what they always do every cycle. And, you know, this is what has always happened. We shouldn't be surprised. Whenever you have low rates and reckless lending, companies will always go to financialization. Yes. Lenders will always go to levering against real estate and financial antics, rather than investing in higher risk innovation, manufacturing, you know, all that stuff. Because there's a greater, it's a longer payback period, higher risk, right? So as long as policy is allowing these sort of, as long as policy supports these kind of conditions, you're going to get that outcome, and no one should be surprised. So what you have to do is you have to outlaw buybacks, except in extremely rare circumstances. You have to let interest rates move higher, because only that puts an investment discipline and a lending discipline back in. and making people carry a heavy portion of the loans that they extend is also necessary mm-hmm. to retain accountability in the system. So, but, you know, here's something I've been hearing a lot of. Some people have flipped who were cautious before and pointing out all the distortions and bubbles and dangers have now flipped to I guess we'll just ride it because they're not
going to stop. I heard that too.
You know, they're going to stop QT in September and central banks are going to go back to full on cut mode and all this. And, you know, they may indeed, I think they will, because this is the only playbook they know is trying to stimulate loan growth, even though it's obviously at the end of that road. But let's not forget they were doing that in December too, Carrie. In December mm-hmm. in Q4, out of the blue, things fell from the sky and people were shocked at the correlations, the positive correlations and the extent to which 94% of the assets in the world went down in 3 months. And that they were doing all their interventions then as well. So it's not as if it's a magic bullet that keeps us from a nasty downturn. You know, the downturn is coming notwithstanding. And the difference this time is they haven't prepared for it. They haven't kept dry powder. They haven't kept 5% of interest rates to move, you know, lower when they need to put a bottom into the business cycle. And so this is really uncharted territory we're in to see how long and how deep and how long it takes for this cycle to clear itself.
Yeah, well, it's going to be messy. I don't know if it's better if it happens really quick and it all just gets flushed or if it drags on for a couple of years. But, you know, talk about rainy day funds. You know, our states here in the U.S. are not probably like your provinces. They're not known to be wise stewards, most of them, of their resources, of their revenues, and of their economies. But there are a number of states here, I think it's 10 or 12 states, that have rainy day funds. And the smart states have been adding to these rainy day funds like it's going out of style because they have so much money coming in. It's just pouring in for a lot from real estate sales. Like one of the major things in Florida, we don't have a real estate, we don't have an income tax rather. So closing costs on properties are much higher. And that's the main industry in Florida is real estate. So they've pulled in so much money, like on stamp taxes, mortgage taxes, you know, all of these
land
things.
Transfer.
Yeah.
It's, yeah, same in Canada. It's been the bulk of budgets. It's been a huge hole filler. Mm-hmm. And now, of course, on the other side of that, as the revenues recede, you've got a big gap that opens up. And P.S., this is not just in Canada or America. Mm-hmm. This is worldwide again, because this morning in Germany, they announced that they're going to finance the public, the pension funds. They have huge deficits in the pension fund.
Surprise.
And so rating agencies are recommending that they introduce a sovereign wealth fund. And that's going to basically help finance the pension deficits by taxes and public debt. So this is an example of a country that is known for its, you know, more fiscal prudence, and it learned something after its hyperinflation days after the war. And so it is sort of known to be more prudent. They have a higher savings rate. They haven't had the same, you know, bubbles in housing. But at the same time, they haven't funded their pensions correctly, and they have the same exact problem. It hasn't been managed properly for the aging demographic, which was evident. We've known about this demographic issue coming for decades now, but nobody prepared for that. Instead, they did all the upfront quick, how do we, you know, make a fast buck and not worry about how do we sustain anything over time?
Oh, it's so true. So true. So, and we're getting to the point, the holes are so deep, they can't be taxed away. You know, the pension crisis around the world, U.S. has it, but it's present in every Western economy because of demographic trends. And like you said, this was visible decades ago, and yet they did nothing. Same thing with Social Security. Basically, the trust, so-called trust fund has run out, and the money, they're getting it now, just basically printing it up. But all of these things were all foreseeable, and yet nothing was done about them by virtually any country in the world. China doesn't have to worry about it. They don't have this big safety net.
Which is why people save more, too, in
exactly.
China, right?
They save 40%, which is part of their problem. I don't see it as a problem necessarily, but they do. It's
for
not
consumption, yeah. It's a depressant on consumption. But so, you know, that's the best thing to do, though, is to self-insure, to save mm-hmm. money, and to keep it out of harm's way. You know, this whole maniacal plan of central banks to get people to give up any kind of principal guarantee and go for these really sketchy assets at really high prices is just, it's like an atom bomb for your financial stability, because it keeps mm-hmm. going off and blowing off chunks, and you yeah. have less and less time to grow it back.
Yeah, it's like they're passing out the Kool-Aid. It looks like Kool-Aid. It smells like Kool-Aid, but it's laced with cyanide. And everybody's drinking it and enjoying it going down. But once it really hits, it's going to be a mass wipeout.
Hey, can I give you an optimistic thought in this?
Yeah,
sometimes I think people like lose optimism. Track of, you know, why we care about the cycle, why we have to be defensive near the top when things are mm-hmm. extremely expensive, and why we need to have cash ready for buying when the cycle moves down. And the reason is because yields, that bread and butter of compound returns, that most essential component of investment returns over time, is yields reinvested for compound returns.
Right.
But people lose sight of that in rising markets where things are frothy and yields are low because assets are high. And they think you just buy things because they're going to go up and you're going to sell it to some other person at a higher price. Yeah. Of course, that's a fool's errand, because eventually the prices mean revert and you're left holding, you know, duds
yeah.
and having losses on your balance sheet. But when we were buying the Canadian bank shares, the Canadian bank sector, back in the lows of 2009.
Yeah, that's when I bought BMO and a couple
yeah,
others.
Yeah, so the dividend yield on BMO at that point was 8.9,
was
CIBC 7.8, Bank of Nova Scotia 6.5, TD 5.9. So overall, the top five banks were yielding about 7% when mm-hmm. you bought near the lows in 2009. Near the peak, they were yielding about 3, near the peak in 2007, and they're yielding about 3 or 4 today. So you know that if you're owning them here, you're not only facing this significant downside risk in a balance sheet style recession, which we have not seen here since the 1980s, to be fair. Australia mm-hmm. hasn't seen one for 27 years. We haven't seen one since about the 1980s. And this is a lot going to impact the banks, not just on the household lending side, but on the corporate exposure side as as the economy makes this big transition. But the upside is you get to buy these franchises for half of their current value in many cases, and your yield is going to be twice as high. So if you can protect capital now and wait patiently for this execution, you can pick up assets that, who cares if they don't recover quickly? Who cares mm-hmm. if it's a 3 or 4 or 5 year, slow recovery from there? If you're mm-hmm. compounding dividends at 7% a year, that's how you double money in short periods of time, not by trying to double it in 1 year and then lose, half again. Like, this is just a madness.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, post-World War II, we got away from the dividend discount model into the pursuing capital gains model, in large part due to poor tax policies. Poorly thought out tax policies, because that's one thing that happens when the government really taxes ordinary income much higher than capital gains. Then capital gains become this manna from heaven, sought after by every investor anywhere they can find it, and it leads to major tax shelter schemes and such.
And I think that's going to be what happens going forward, because they have to follow the property now. With people so deficit in savings and incomes so depressed, they have to follow the property owners who have benefited from the big inflation in the past few years from the QE policies. Mm-hmm. Now they have to go after capital gains. Property taxes are going to go up. This is where the bulk of the taxation that's desperately needed, because they have big holes everywhere, is going to follow that money trail. And I think that we should expect that to be the case.
I think it's really problematical. I don't think there's any easy answers, especially if the capital gains in property get wiped out. I think some kind of accommodation with the debt is going to have to be made. I don't know what it's going to be. The Jubilee is always appealing, but that will lead to the complete downfall of the banking sector. So you have to be prepared for that. So mm-hmm. I'm not sure what the answer is, but an answer will be found. That much we can be optimistic about. It might not be one that we all like. In any event, make sure you go check out Danielle's work and her latest article on jugglingdynamite.com. The one that you just wrote today, Danielle, and other news, synchronized global growth has collapsed, which you provide ample charts for that. And then your second one, with dealing with housing prices, paying for the crazy years, home prices leading economy down. I think if you can read those two articles, Danielle's style is pretty readable, understandable. You will get a really good picture of what's going on, have a better idea of what you need to do to be prepared for it. Anyway, follow us over at financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Sign up for the newsletter. And Danielle, we'll catch you in a couple of weeks.
Okay, thanks, Gary.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.